This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Baker, is widely regarded as one of the top diplomats and campaign strategists of his generation. He would have led a very different life had he accepted the advice from his grandfather, the advice which inspired the title of Baker's new memoir, Work Hard, Study, and Keep Out of Politics. Baker served as Secretary of State and Chief of Staff to President George H.W. Bush. In the Reagan administration, he was Chief of Staff and Secretary of the Treasury. Under Ford, Baker was Undersecretary of Commerce. Baker led presidential campaigns for each of them. He also oversaw the Florida recount for the Bush-Cheney campaign. Baker is now a senior partner in the law firm Baker Botts. He's declined full-time positions in the administration of President George W. Bush, but at the request of Congress and with the approval of the White House, he agreed to co-chair with Lee Hamilton a bipartisan commission to assess the situation in Iraq and recommend how to proceed. Considering how divided Democrats and Republicans have been, I asked Baker what the odds are of the commission members reaching a consensus.
Well, Lee Hamilton and I have discussed this on a couple of occasions, and we have concluded, and so have the rest, the other eight members of our commission, that if, unless we can bring a consensus report, it's not going to have much effect. So we're going to make every effort that we can to come with consensus recommendations. The choice really should not be one between picking up, i.e. cutting and running, and or just staying the course. I mean, there are other options other than just those two. Those are the two options that you hear most frequently now as we go into a national election, because one party staked out stay the course position, one party staked out the redeploy or withdraw position. But there are other options other than just those two. And we will come with some recommendations that I hope will be consensus. I honestly believe they will be. They will not all be recommendations that please either one side or the other.
Now, you wrote a couple of op-ed pieces about Iraq. One of them was written in the New York Times 7 months before the invasion, and you argued in that the only realistic way to effect regime change in Iraq is through the application of military force, including sufficient ground troops to occupy the country, depose the current leadership, and install a successor government. But it can't be done on the cheap. And you suggested that the right way to go about things was to seek a Security Council resolution requiring Iraq to submit to intrusive inspections. You said if we are to change the regime in Iraq, we'll have to occupy the country militarily. The cost of doing so, politically, economically, and in terms of casualties, could be great. They will be lessened if the president brings together an international coalition behind the effort. And then in January of 2003, the James Baker Institute for Public Policy and the Council on Foreign Relations produced a joint study of guiding principles for post-conflict policy in Iraq. And in that, you recommended that the Iraq Army be preserved, not disbanded, to serve as a guarantor of peace and stability. And the report wrote that it was wishful thinking to suggest that Iraqi oil revenues would be sufficient to pay for post-conflict reconstruction. So the recommendations that you've made pretty consistently were not the directions that the Bush administration headed in. I know you don't really like to talk about conversations you've had with the president, because you want to be discreet about that. But nevertheless, I'll ask, did you ever talk with the president directly about these recommendations?
Let me answer that question this way, Terry, by saying that every time the president told me early on in the administration, whenever you're in Washington, please call my secretary. You don't go through the system. Just call my secretary. Tell her you're going to be here. And if it's convenient, if I can do it, I would very much like to see you. And I do call, and I do see him more often than not. I'd say maybe 80 or 90% of the time I happen to be in Washington, I will let his secretary Karen know, and I will go over there for 45 minutes to an hour, and we will discuss a whole host of different things, including policy and personnel. And therefore, I have an ironclad rule that what we talk about in those sessions stays in the Oval Office. So I really don't want to get into that. What I wrote in the op-ed was valid in retrospect. And I think what the Baker Institute for Public Policy's study showed was valid in retrospect. And that's why I say in the book that I think we made some costly mistakes by disbanding the Iraqi army. Sometimes the administration would say, well, we didn't disband the Iraqi army. They disbanded themselves, but we did nothing, of course, to preserve it. And so I think that was a mistake, and maybe not securing weapons depots was a mistake. And I think we've learned that if we're going to do this, we could not do it. We could not do it on the cheap. And of course, that's one of the reasons that back in 1991, in the first Gulf War, we really never seriously entertained the idea of taking down the regime, which would have involved going to Baghdad, occupying that big Arab country. So I'm sorry to decline to talk to you about what I talked to the president about, but it's not something I ought to do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to him every time I come to Washington.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Baker, and he served as Chief of Staff and Secretary of the Treasury under President Reagan and Secretary of State and Chief of Staff under President George H.W. Bush. James Baker has written a new memoir called Work Hard, Study, and Keep Out of Politics. During the Gulf War, you spent a lot of time flying back and forth to Syria, getting Syria on board. Tom Friedman, when he was recently on Fresh Air, during the war between Israel and Hezbollah, spoke about how hard you worked to practice diplomacy with Syria and get them on board with the Bush administration. Now it seems the Bush administration isn't talking to Syria about the Middle East. And I'm wondering if you think that we should be talking to them.
Yes, I do. I do, because when we were gearing up an unprecedented international coalition in connection with the first Gulf War, we were even able, by talking to Syria, to get them to join the coalition to kick an Arab neighbor out of Kuwait through the use of force. They even sent a division of troops down to fight alongside American forces. I went to Syria 15 times, and on the 16th trip, we got President Hafez Assad to change 25 years of policy and agree to come sit down face-to-face with Israel, sit down across the table, and thereby implicitly recognized Israel's right to exist, even though they were still formally at war. And we got that done by talking to them, and we were talking to them even though they were a state that we was on our list of states that sponsored terrorism. And you know, my view is you don't talk just to your friends, you talk as well to your enemies. You need to talk to your enemies in order to move forward diplomatically and toward peace. And talking to someone, in my opinion at least, my personal opinion, does not equate to appeasement. You have to be firm, you got to be strong, and you got to know what you're doing, and you got to be tough. But talking to someone is not a reward, it's not appeasement, and therefore I think we should be doing that, to answer your question.
What role do you think Syria could play now in the Middle East conflict?
Well, Syria is more of a player today, perhaps, than she was even back there when we got her to change 25 years of policy and come to the Madrid conference, because she is the conduit by which Hezbollah is supplied. And, of course, Iran furnishes the money and the weapons, but Syria is the transit point. Syria also, in my opinion, has influence with Hamas. And I think Syria can be prevailed upon to use that influence to convince Hamas to accept Israel's right to exist in order to get the Palestinian-Israeli talks back on track. So I think there are a number of things Syria can do. They can do more towards sealing their border with Iraq to help us in Iraq. And my view is that Syria is a Sunni nation that would, given the chance, would prefer to be close to the United States rather than close to Iran. Now, you won't know any of that unless you're willing to engage and to find out. And so my view would be that that would be a very useful thing for us to try.
Do you think we should be talking to Iran, too? You say, you know, you talk to your enemies.
Well, I think we are talking to Iran. We're doing it indirectly right now. Let me say that when I was Secretary of State, we offered to sit down with Iran at the official level of Secretaries of State. But the truth of the matter is the Iranian government had done such a good job of vilifying the United States as the great Satan that they could never get the domestic political support necessary to sit down with us. That may still be, to some extent, the case. But there are ways you can talk. We are talking through the Europeans right now, particularly on the nuclear issue. There are other ways that we can talk through intermediaries. And, of course, there's always the possibility of challenging Iran to sit down with us at the level of Secretary of State and see if, who knows, you might end up putting them on the defensive. They might come back and say, no, we're really not quite ready for that. But it may be a little premature to take that step. But we do need to find a way to have communications with them for a host of reasons, not the least of which is their nuclear program. They are also now big players in Iraq, very big players. You have a Shiite government in Iraq, and, of course, Iran is a Shiite country.
Are you concerned, as some critics say, that America has lost a lot of its influence internationally by because of the war in Iraq and because it has declined to practice diplomacy with countries like Syria, because it didn't take a more active role in the Middle East, certainly, you know, before the war between Israel and Hezbollah. So do you think we've actually lost some of our influence and that we have a more negative image now internationally?
Well, I think we have a more negative image. I'm not sure that I would agree that we've lost our influence, maybe some of our, but lost, you know, we're still pretty well feared by our adversaries. What you'd like to be in foreign policy and foreign affairs is respected by your allies and feared by your adversaries. I think we still are feared by our adversaries. We have a job to do in repairing some of our historic alliances, but I have to tell you that in the second term, it seems to me that President Bush and Secretary Rice are doing everything they should be doing to try and repair those alliances. Those alliances that were ruptured during the lead up to the Iraq War.
In addition to all your work as a statesman, you're also a lawyer with a firm co-founded by your great-grandfather, Baker Botts. And the company's clients include many oil companies, including oil companies that have interests in the Persian Gulf. The company has also represented the Saudi royal family. You've also been a member of the Carlyle Group, which is an investment bank that has bought and sold a lot of companies in the defense industry. So the question of conflict of interest has come up in your career. As somebody who has dealt with and deals with American policy and American foreign relations, you know, being so caught up in oil interests and the defense industry and the Saudi family. And I wonder what your reaction is to people who think that there have been times when there is a conflict of interest.
Well, if there were, then I would have been prosecuted by the Justice Department, because you can't have a conflict of interest when you serve in government. Let me also say that when I was in government, I was not a member of Baker Botts Law Firm, never had been in my life. I had worked for another firm in Houston because Baker Botts had an anti-nepotism rule, nor was I a member of the Carlyle Group.
But you have been affiliated with the Carlyle Group.
After I left government.
Right.
After I left government, yeah.
Haven't you also been affiliated with Baker Botts?
No, no, ma'am. I never had been affiliated. I never went. I never worked for Baker Botts until after I left government for the last time back in 1993.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But after that, you were, for instance, working as President Bush's special envoy to forgive some of their debt to Iraq, forgive
Iraq debt. And mm-hmm. what I did at that time was to waive any rights I had to any fees that the law firm earned from any issues, countries, or matters that had anything whatsoever to do with that issue. I just waived my right to a lot of compensation as a consequence of doing that, and that's the way I solved the conflict of interest problem. And we ran all that by the ethics people in the White House, and I assume the ethics and government people.
But I should mention the New York Times had an editorial saying that, quote, Mr. Baker is far too entangled in a matrix of lucrative private business relationships that leave him looking like a potentially interested party in any debt restructuring formula, and this pertained to being the special envoy.
Well, that's right. They did write that. They said, they also said in the first part of that editorial, Terry, if I'm not mistaken, there could be no better pick for this job in terms of his experience in government or something like that. And then they said, but we think there's too much here and so forth. And they didn't like it, but it was legal. And they didn't like it. Well, New York Times disagrees, I guess, with a lot of the things I did when I was in government.
I know that there are a lot of Americans who are concerned that there are so many people recently who have had key positions in American government who have a lot of oil interests. You know, Vice President Cheney had been the head of Halliburton. Both President Bushes had been involved in the oil industry. Baker Botts represents a lot of oil companies with interests in the Persian Gulf. So the question comes up, like when dealing with foreign policy relating to oil-rich countries, or when dealing with environmental and energy issues, are key people in government motivated at all by their own personal financial interests or by personal contacts that they've developed through financial interests over the years? And I just wonder what you'd want to say to those people who are concerned about that.
Well, I don't think that that's a proper concern unless the interest is pretty direct. Let me say to you that in the two terms of the Reagan administration, if you read the book, you'll see this. I never participated in any energy related matter when I was White House Chief of Staff, and for the most part when I was Treasury Secretary, and I write about that in there. And in fact, when the suggestion was made that I ought to leave, instead of leaving the White House to become Treasury Secretary, I ought to be Secretary of the Interior, even President Reagan himself said that won't work because Jim is disqualified on dealing with energy issues. I never participated in those. With respect to Baker Botts, my answer is the same as it was before. When I was in government, I had no affiliation with Baker Botts. You could say that my former law firm, Andrews Kurth, also represented some oil company, but I don't. That's a pretty darn indirect interest. I mean, the fact that you belong to a big law firm that has literally hundreds of clients, and some of them are in the energy business. I don't understand what you're supposed to do when you leave, and when you leave government, if you've been a practicing lawyer before you came in. Just say you're only going to join a firm that doesn't have energy clients. Let me go back to oil for a minute, because to a lot of people, that's a dirty word, and I'm not sure that it ought to be. To a country like ours that uses so much of it and depends so much on it for energy. But I've been in four administrations, and in every one of those administrations, that is Ford, the two Reagan administrations and the first Bush administration, every one of those administrations, we had a written policy that we would go to war to defend secure access to the energy reserves of the Persian Gulf. That's very important to the economic and I would even say political interests of the United States. Those were written policies. When you formulate and implement foreign policy for the United States, you have to look at principles and values, yes, but you also have to look at national interests. And we've always had a strong national interest in preserving secure access to the energy reserves of the Persian Gulf.
In 2000, during the Florida recount, you represented the Bush-Cheney campaign in the recount. And then after that, you co-chaired an election reform commission with President Carter. What are some of the changes you would still like to see made in the way we go about elections in the United States?
Well, we had 87 different suggestions in our report. Perhaps the number one recommendation was that we should move towards some sort of a photo ID for voting, because we think the country is moving in that direction. And we further believe, and President Carter joined me in this belief, that minorities and the disadvantaged, who've been the most opposed to the idea of some national ID card, they would be better off with a photo ID, because it would be hard to conceive of a voting clerk turning someone down to vote who could present a government issued photo ID to prove that he or she was who they said they were. But our recommendation went further. Our recommendation said, in addition, this should be phased in not until 2010, and the states and the county voting authorities should couple this with active efforts to go out and find people who were not registered and register them, and if anyone could not afford to pay for the birth certificate necessary to prove so you get your photo ID card or whatever it might be, then they should be given those cards free. It was a good recommendation. I think more and more states are going to move in that direction. We're at a point today in this country, particularly because of the security problem that we have after 9/11, that you need a photo ID now to do almost anything, to get on an airplane, to buy liquor, to buy cigarettes, to go into a federal building. And we think that a photo ID will do a lot to protect those people who in the past have opposed that idea because they were members of minority groups or the disadvantaged.
One of the phenomenons that we've been seeing lately, maybe phenomenon isn't the right word, but there are, you know, the Secretary of State that oversees the state's Secretary of State that oversees the elections is often a very partisan figure, like Catherine Harris, who was the Secretary of State in the 2000 election in Florida. Was co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign.
Yeah, we call for an end to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of our recommendations was that the chief elections officers of the state should not be chairman of partisan political campaigns, I mean, except for their own, I mean, in states where they have to be elected. But that's going to be up to each state, Terry. And a lot of our recommendations, by the way, of those 87 recommendations, are dependent upon whether the states and or the Congress implement them.
In Bob Woodward's new book about the Bush administration, he writes that George H.W. Bush, according to Brent Scowcroft, that George H.W. Bush was in agony and tormented by the war and what had happened afterwards. And I'll quote here from Woodward's book. In his younger years, Scowcroft thought, George W. couldn't decide whether he was going to rebel against his father or try to beat him at his own game. Now he had tried at the game, and it was a disaster. Scowcroft was sure that Bush 41 would never have behaved this way, not in a million years. As someone who served in the administration of George H.W. Bush, and I assume you're still in touch with him, does this ring true to you?
You need to talk to Brent Scowcroft about that. That's Brent Scowcroft's view, and you need to talk to him about that.
Do you share that view?
I'm not gonna get into that. I'll tell you what I've done, and I think I mentioned it in the book. I may not, but I've oftentimes mentioned it to interviewers because I worked for so many presidents, four. particularly, and so many in succession, Ford, Reagan, two terms, and Bush, everybody used to come to me and said, tell us about, compare so-and-so to so-and-so, and I always refused to do that because any time you say something nice about one, you're in effect or implicitly criticizing the other. So I stay out of that, and I stay out of stuff like that would put someone, what president I worked for, on the couch. I'm just not going to get into that.
Well, James Baker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Terry.
James Baker's new memoir is called Work Hard, Study, and Keep Out of Politics.